Okay, we're going to continue on where we left off last week. Okay, great. We're going to pick up where we left off last week. We're talking about technology's impact on halakha. And I gave a lot of details, and I don't want to lose the forest amidst all these trees, and a lot of trees, especially if you have a handout, it'll help you organize all of the trees in this forest that I'm trying to paint. And let me just try to review some of the major points that I was trying to develop. I'm trying to show that technology has impacted at least seven areas of life. Number one, it has made obscure passages in the Gemara become incredibly relevant. One point I could add from last week is the topic of grumma, of indirect action, something that was esoteric, something that was a rarity for this to be relevant, discussed in the Gemara, maybe once or twice in Gemara Shabbos. And today, grumma plays such a leading role, such a major impact on Shabbos today. We talk about refrigerators and the other examples we see in Tzahal. Okay, there we go. Tzahal, the Israeli army, has purchased, I saw on JPost, hundreds of Shabbat phones that operate by grumma. So we see this topic that was this esoteric, once upon a time esoteric, now has become a part and parcel of daily Torah life. That was one point, that the obscure passages in the Gemara come alive. The second point is that technology allows us to see that which we never saw before. What does halacha say about that? We spoke about that. And we spoke about bifurcation of phenomena, of various phenomena that used to be very simple, and technology has bifurcated them. What do we say about these new developments? We say, for example, we spoke about fire. What is considered to be fire? It's something considered to be a fire without fuel consumption, without a flame. And then we started speaking about, we're going to pick up this week, how technology has fused various phenomena. Not only has it bifurcated various phenomena, it's actually fused various phenomena. We started on that last week. We gave the example of mikvah and filter, but I want to speak about a fascinating question, two very fascinating questions. And this question of fusion of phenomena, in these two cases, are actually pulled in two different directions. Let's start taking a look at the question. We'll start with the question that I have on the handout, section D, source 2. And this is about a reattached limb to a Kohen's body. Let's talk about, let me give some background information to this issue. We know that a Kohen cannot become a Metame Lanes, cannot come in contact with the dead. But this is not only with an entire dead body, but it's also an Aver Min HaChai, even if it is a limb from a body, if it's been removed from that body, the Kohen cannot come in contact with that limb. That limb is considered to be dead. And this would apply, writes the 18th century post-Sefer Notei Behuda, this applies even Aver Shel Atzmo, even if it is one's own limb, the Kohen would not be allowed to be Matame. So if he had a leg amputated, he would not be able to keep that leg, the amputated leg, in his house for some odd reason, if someone would want to do that. And the question that arises in the modern age is that, what if a Kohen, loses a limb, a finger? Is he allowed to have that finger reattached to his body? Because this is not a danger of life. This is not a danger of life. Doesn't seem to justify violating an Isser Lav, a Torah prohibition, a negative Torah prohibition. And he certainly is not allowed to be Matame. It's included in his prohibition to become Tame, is the prohibition to become in contact even with his own, a limb from his own body that's been severed. So can it be reattached? Now the Svara, the reasoning that one could, the approach that one could take to say that it would be permissible is that once the limb is reattached to the Kohen's body, well, the limb is part of the Kohen's body, and it's not considered to be mace, not considered to be dead anymore. That limb has sort of become, has experienced a tchias ha-mesim. It's been reawoken. It's no longer dead. So here's the question, this fusion of phenomena that modern technology has created. In the pre-modern age, the separated limb was a separate phenomenon from the Kohen's body. Now they become one. Does Allah recognize it as that reattached limb as an integral part of the Kohen's body, and therefore no longer considered to be dead? It's a very, very interesting question. Without giving the answer, obviously our biases find a way to want to permit reattaching a limb to a Kohen's body. And a contrasting question we find about another example of fusion of phenomena, but here we sort of want to, if we want to be lenient, we have to cut in a different direction. This is a question that arose in the 1980s, and that was the question of a pacemaker, that if somebody had a pacemaker attached to their heart, and then the person died, the question became, are you allowed to remove the pacemaker from the body after the person has died? Because there's halacha, we mentioned it last week, that there's an iser hanam and ames, that we're not allowed to benefit from a dead body. So do we say we have this item, the pacemaker, that has been attached to the body, it's been inserted into the body internally? The question is, do we consider this an integral part of the body? And its fusions become one. So if you use this pacemaker as one with a body, then it would seem that we would be forbidden to remove the pacemaker from the body after the person has died. And especially when the technology began, that posed a hardship on hospitals, especially Israeli hospitals, that didn't have that much money. And a pacemaker costs a lot of money, and if you're a pacemaker from a dead body, that would cost a hospital thousands of dollars that they did not necessarily have. So what we're saying is that the pacemaker, we'd prefer not to view it as an integral part of the body, as fused with the body, considered that is, we hopefully don't want to view it as being, as constituting one entity together with the body. On the other hand, we want the reattached limb to be viewed as one entity, as with the body, so as to permit a limb to be reattached to the Kohen. It's an interesting phenomena how technology has impacted on halacha. That's the fourth area in which I wanted to show you how technology has impacted on halacha, what halacha has to evaluate in various phenomena that have arisen. Now I'd like to go to the fifth impact, and this I'd like to spend a considerable amount of time, and that is the question of the technology rendering the reasons for various halachot mute. Moot. I'd like to take a look at a number of examples of this phenomenon, and we'll begin with the question that many of us are familiar with, and that is taking medicine on Shabbos. Chazal, welcome, Esther. Thank you for joining us. The Chazal, the rabbis forbade taking medicine on Shabbos, and the concern was lest one come to grind medicine on Shabbos. And this certainly fit to the pre-modern age, where if one needed some medicine, they would go to the local pharmacist in their house. They'd have medicines, and they would grind it up. This is a very, very relevant concern. The modern age, when medicines are made in a factory, and hardly anyone grinds medicine before they take it, so does this prohibition still apply? Basically, the reason for this prohibition has been rendered moot, no longer relevant. So does this halacha still apply? So almost all the Rabbanim agree that this halacha still applies because of a rule that the Gemara articulates in Beitza that kol davar shebeminyan tzarach minyan acher la'atiro, that if there is a rabbinic enactment that has been legislated by the rabbis, the only way they could be overturned is if a rabbinic body that is greater in stature than the original body overturns that edict. And since we don't have a rabbinic body that's considered to be greater than in scholarship than the rabbis of the Talmud, the Talmudic enactments remain in place, even if its reasons do not apply. There does seem to be an exception, however, and that is Rabbi Waldenberg, the author of the Shas and Shuvah Sitzel Yezer, suggests something very, very interesting. He wants to suggest that perhaps medicine that is made in, or can only be made in a factory, that the prohibition of medicine would not apply to that type of taking that kind of medicine on Shabbos. And the reason could be is that the rabbis never issued their decree regarding items that are made outside the house. Perhaps they only issued the prohibition to take medicine on Shabbos for those, that's a good point, exactly, like pot palta, right, that's a perfect example, and we're going to see something very, very related to that. That's correct. It's an interesting possibility. Now, what Rabbi Waldenberg is doing is a typical technique that Rabban in the modern age use, and that is to say that the prohibition still remains, but the parameters of the prohibition perhaps can be narrowed, because we can say that the rabbis did not issue their edict to apply to the new situations that technology has created. Let's see a related topic to something that Rabbi Kelman has brought up very appropriately, and that is the concept of Bishul Akum, that is the prohibition that Chazal instituted that we are not supposed to eat food that was cooked by a non-Jew. And the question, and I remember the first time hearing about this prohibition, I was in high school, and I fell into shock. I came home, and I realized, oh my goodness, all the food that we have in the house, all the canned foods, are all cooked by a non-Jew. So how in the world would this be mutter for us to eat? So I was looking through all the food. I was asking my mother, how can we eat this? And when in reality, many of the rabbanim want to suggest that the entire prohibition of Bishul Akum would not apply to foods that can be made only in a factory. Again, this idea that we don't say the prohibition doesn't apply in the modern circumstance, but in a situation where the food can only be made in a factory, and the whole reason for this prohibition doesn't apply, then there's room to be lenient. Because the reason why Chazal made this enactment forbidding us to eat food cooked by a non-Jew is to prevent intermarriage. So that's one thing. That would apply if there's some sort of a connection between you and the non-Jews cooking you the food. Let's say if your neighbor makes you some nice pasta. However, if the pasta is made in a factory, there is absolutely no connection between you and the factory worker that made this food. So it seems the reason wouldn't apply. So we can't just throw out the prohibition and say it no longer applies. But Judah, one second. But there's room to say that certain circumstances doesn't apply. What about people with non-Jewish help who cook? Is that a problem? Yeah, the answer is right. I'll answer Glenn's question. The reason for Yom Tov Sheni exactly doesn't apply. Once there's a calendar, the reason for Yom Tov Sheni, so certainly the reason for Yom Tov Sheni doesn't apply when there's email, when you can get information can be spread worldwide in an instant. Right? It's a very good point. Judah, your question about what about people with non-Jewish help who cook? Is that a problem? The answer is yes. Yes, it is. It is a problem. There is one opinion that the Tosfos quote that say that the prohibition doesn't apply to a worker. So maybe there's a little bit of room to be lenient that the prohibition only applies in a social setting, not in a setting where your employee cooks food for you. There's a little room to be lenient. If you want to take a look into this topic further, you can visit the website for my school, TorahAcademy.org. I'm sorry, KolTorah.org. KolTorah.org, where I have an article on Bishul Akum, and we discuss this in some detail. If you didn't catch the website, you can just Google Jachter and Bishul Akum. You'll be able to find the article. Okay. Now, the other example I wanted to give, the final example I wanted to give regarding halacha and reasoning, is a very, very sensitive one. And that is, I think we started talking about it last week a little bit, we'll expand it this week, and that is a deaf mute. The deaf mute is regarded by the halacha as being someone who is lav b'nei deaf, someone who is not mentally competent. But in the last 150 years, people who are deaf and mute are able to be trained, and they can speak a little bit, they can communicate, they're certainly intelligent. And it's hard in this day and age to describe someone who is a cheresh, someone who is a deaf mute, as someone who is not mentally competent, and therefore they're not chayav mitzvos. They wouldn't have to put on tefillin. They would be even able to eat things that are not kosher. It's very difficult to say that in the modern context. On the other hand, you have the rabbis said that the deaf mute is considered to be not mentally competent. It's a very difficult situation. How do we deal with this? I think the rabbanan try to squeak by and say that as long as the deaf mute can speak a little bit, then even the words not so very clear what they're saying, that we would not consider them to be mentally incompetent. We would consider them mentally competent. They would be able to get an aliyah in shul. They would be able to count towards the minyan, and other ramifications of mental competence. Okay, adkan for the fifth area we discuss of technology's impact on halacha. Now let's move on to the sixth area. Rosh Chodesh Adar Cheresh nowadays is not a deaf mute, rather developmentally handicapped. Oh, I see. That's interesting. Now, it's interesting that you're mentioning Rosh Chodesh. That's important to mention it, because Rosh Chodesh, I think more than any other posek, is open to saying that the halacha is changing with circumstances. So, I just wanted to give an example. Rav Schechter's father, unfortunately, passed away 2 weeks ago. And at the funeral at YU, he walked in with sneakers. At the funeral, normally the Avelim, the mourners, start wearing their sneakers only after the burial is completed. And when I went to pay a shiva call, a friend of mine that I teach with, one of the Rebbeim in our yeshiva, asked Rav Schechter, why were you wearing these sneakers? Rav Schechter said that the entire reason why an onen is allowed to wear shoes is because that's necessary for taking care of the funeral arrangements. But today, when we have the option of wearing sneakers, he felt that the reason no longer applies that would permit the mourner to wear shoes until the time of the burial. Therefore, he was ready wearing sneakers even before the burial. So it's not the way most of the community practices, but it is interesting. But Rav Schechter is an example of someone who is more than willing to go in whatever direction, be it strict or be it lenient, regarding changes because of technology and other developments. Okay. Now let's talk about time.
I don't know if I can answer that.
How time has changed, as our perception of time has changed as a result of technology. And I'm going to be speaking specifically about the international dateline. Now, the international dateline has, so to speak, always existed, and there's a phenomenon that the international dateline grapples with is an age-old issue. But the modern technology has caused us to confront the questions of crossing the international dateline with greater and greater frequency, something that was an enormous rarity in the pre-modern age. So So for example, I this when I was the when I was a, an acting rav in my shul in Teaneck this past summer, regarding Shabbat Batamos, I received an entire a wide variety of questions. One question was from one congregant was traveling west on Shabbat Batamos, crossing the date line on Shabbat Batamos into Yud Ches until the next day in the middle of the fast. Another person was going to be crossing the international date line heading east after he already fasted. He wanted to know if he had to fast a second time. So one person wanted to know if he has to fast a second time. Another person wanted to know whether he can fast less. And then even a third person asked an even more unbelievable question. And that was, he was going to be traveling on the night of Shivasa B'Tamuz. And then while he's traveling, while it's still night, it turns into the night of Yud Ches Tamuz. And then he missed Shivasa B'Tamuz altogether. So it's a fascinating issue that comes up with the international date line. And basically what Rabbanim say regarding a fast is that you follow the fast regarding where you are. In other words, if where you are is considered to be Shavuot V'Tamuz, you fast. If where you are is not considered to be Shavuot V'Tamuz, you don't have to fast. So if you are traveling 10 o'clock in the morning on Shavuot V'Tamuz and all of a sudden you've crossed the international date line and you've crossed into Yud Ches Tamuz, you no longer have to fast. You've changed dates. Very, very fascinating topic. Yes, Rabbi Kelman, go ahead. Go ahead, Rabbi Kelman. Can't hear you. Rabbi Kelman, we're waiting. Do you want to text your? Do you want to write out your what you want your comment? You want me to go ahead? Okay, I'll proceed further. Now, the distinction that I wanted to draw regarding time is between time and date. Too long to write. Okay, I'm sorry that we missed that. Let's explain what I mean, the difference between time and date. Let's give an example. Let's say it's 9:30 Eastern Standard Time on Monday, March 12th. Please discuss the why, as I understand there's some issues. Let me just talk, but before I move forward, I'll address Judah's question. I'm going to be discussing questions about crossing the international date line. I'll talk briefly a minute about where the international date line is. That is a great machlokas that Rabbanim have been debating since the early part of the 20th century, and that is, where does the halacha regard the international date line to, where the date line to be? Do we recognize that three basic opinions? There's a lot more, but the three basic opinions are that we accept the international date line as a halachic date line. Some say that it's 90 degrees from Yerushalayim. Others say it's 180 degrees from Yerushalayim. So depending on which sheet you hold, depends on where you observe Shabbos in Hawaii. According to some opinions, you observe Shabbos in Hawaii on what everybody calls Friday. And others say, because they hold that you've already crossed the date line by the time you come to Shabbos, if you hold the date line, it's 180 degrees from Yerushalayim. And others say that that no, it's not. You haven't crossed the date line yet. It's a good question. You observe Shabbos in Hawaii on what people call Saturday, what people call Friday. Very interesting shaila. Shaila also came up with, if you have to write a get in the middle of the week, well, which day you write? You write the date. It's on Tuesday. You write Wednesday. Big shaila. It came up. This question, a friend of mine had to write a get in Honolulu. Then the question comes about Japan and New Zealand. Do you observe Shabbos on what people call Sunday or what people call Shabbos? If it's 90 degrees, if the date line is 90 degrees from Yerushalayim, you have not crossed the date line yet in Japan, and while the international community views that you have, the halakhic community may believe that you have not. So that's the question about the international date line. And if you want to take a look at it further with a beautiful map, you can take a look also at our website, koltorah.org. Okay, now let's talk about the distinction between time and date. So let's say it's 9:35 Eastern Standard Time, and I'm eating an apple on Monday night, March 12th. And let's say somebody in Hong Kong at the very same moment, the exact same time, is eating an apple. So we're both eating an apple at the same time, but we're not eating the apple on the same date. It's a fascinating idea. So that's what I mean to say there's a difference between time and date. And this plays out in the following distinction. We said as far as the Tanis is concerned, as far as the fast and probably about Shabbos and Yom Tov, you follow the place that you are. If where you are, it is Tzom Gedalia, you fast. If it is where you are, it is the fourth day of Tishrei, you don't have to fast. But yet for some matters, we'd say that Pidyon HaBen, for example, we say that you'd have to wait 31 full days. So for example, if a baby was born in Toronto, and one of the parents live in Australia, and the Australian in-laws are saying, you have to bring the baby to Australia for a Pidyon HaBen, okay. The question is, how do you, if you travel from Toronto or Oak Park to Australia, you've crossed the international date line going west. You've moved ahead a day. So when do you conduct the Pidyon HaBen? We know that you conduct the Pidyon HaBen 31 days, but do you say, let's say this baby was born on Chaf Adar, do we say that Chaf Aleph, let's say for argument, say Chaf Aleph Nisan, that's the 31st day after he was born. Okay, that's it. Do the Pidyon HaBen. Or no. Perhaps you have to say you need 31 full days to be completed. That's the Torah says. You need 30 days, and that baby has to have lived 30 full days, and then on the 31st day, you can perform the Pidyon HaBen. And so it seems that as far as a fast is concerned, what concerns us is the date of where you are. And then as far as the Pidyon HaBen is concerned, the date is not the determining factor, but rather it is time. How much time has elapsed since the baby has born? We need 31 days to have elapsed. Very, very fascinating issue. Okay, Rabbi Kalman, shoot.
Okay, can you hear me? Okay.
Well, you are. Go ahead.
I think you can hear me. Can you hear me? Okay. Back to Shabbat HaRetzalus, because the whole thing on the international date line and timing, I think there's a double clue. When I flew to Israel on Shabbat HaRetzalus once, so you're right, we left 2:00 in the afternoon in the summer, and 3 hours later we start and we ate. But I think if you leave Israel, let's say Shabbat HaRetzalus, then you're in trouble, because you have an extra 7 hours of fasting. And I remember our chapter quoted that there's a Mali Smach that when the fast ends in Israel, which is like 2 hours anyway earlier than in Toronto, so it's like 9 hours earlier, you don't have to fast for, you know, the day plus seven. You can be maker on both ends of the spectrum. And you don't have to fast till it starts, but only till it starts in Yerushalayim.
That's because there's room to say that, possibility to say, and everybody agrees with this, that perhaps the minhag to fast on Shavuot Batamas and Bizman HaZeh that we're now living under persecution, thank God, the fasting on Shavuot Batamas is only a minhag, is a custom. And therefore, one could make the argument that the custom only applied to fast a full normal day. And to fast a fast that is prolonged by technology was never accepted as part of the original minhag, the original custom. So that sort of fits into what we said earlier. Yeah, that was the argument. That's sort of Rabbi Shapter's argument. But it's fundamentally, we do still agree as far as the fast is concerned, you follow the date where you are. And once it's no longer Shavuos Matam, it's absurd, it's meaningless to fast. Okay? All right. Now let's move forward to the next issue. Emailing from F2. Okay, trying to show how the impact, how time has... Sphere is a big... Sphere is a big issue. I'm not gonna touch that one. And the question of when do you observe Shavuos, that becomes a very touchy issue. No problem. Okay, I guess it just shows you... What I'm just trying to bring out is not the issues, the specific issues, but rather just how technology has just changed our entire perspective of what time is all about. It's a fascinating issue. Judah, what of the person who wasn't anywhere? What do you mean by that? I don't understand your question, Judah. All right, the person who missed... Yeah, Rav Shapter said that he doesn't have to fast Shavuos with Thomas. Now, it would be also to deliberately plan out a way to avoid Shavuos Matamos. But this is someone, this has just occurred, he didn't plan this out, he didn't realize it. One could skip Tisha B'Av. Yes. Yes. Right. Now you wouldn't, it's definitely also to deliberately try to avoid any fast. Some, by the way, I've heard there are people who have a hard time conceiving, women ovulating before they go to the mikvah, but if they travel west, crossing the international date line, and they go, let's say they go to Toronto, go to the mikvah in Toronto, they can go to the mikvah probably about 13 hours earlier than they would have otherwise, and that may be a way to solve the problem of Orthodox infertility. An interesting issue. Just not everybody agrees with that. If you could space, right, Ilana liked that. If you can space, you can really speed up the days, right. Space is a whole other issue, that's right. Now, it's an important issue, again, it shows you how technology has changed the idea of time. Our whole concept of time has changed. Okay, Rabbi Kahn wants to know why. Okay, because we're supposed to put ourselves into a situation where we can fulfill mitzvah. So, for example, for the males that are in the shir, we put ourselves in a position where we are chayv to in the midst of tzitzis. We deliberately wear a four-corner garment that needs tzitzis. Otherwise, we don't wear four-corner garments today. So therefore, you're supposed to put yourself into a position to do a mitzvah. You're not supposed to find tricky ways to avoid it. Is it a mitzvah? Okay, we have to make up the fast, and you wouldn't have to make up the fast. Oh, is it a mitzvah or an isser? Right, like Mechiras Chametz. You're just dodging the isser. Yilachar, it's a mitzvah to fast on that day. So it's not right to just avoid it. But you're right, you're right on target, asking the right question. Okay. Making up a fast only applies to an individual fast day. But if it is a public fast, then if one misses that public fast, you don't have to make up the fast day. Okay, let's go now to more examples regarding time. Here's a question that I like a lot. The question of emailing and faxing into Shabbos. So let's say it's Friday afternoon in Oak Park, Michigan. And you are checking your emails, you see your friends from Israel have sent you some emails, so can you email into Shabbos? It's an interesting question. Are you really emailing into Shabbos? Are you really intermailing into cyberspace? I don't know when Shabbos starts in cyberspace, but let's give a better example. Let's say you want to send a fax to a business in Eretz Yisrael, which presumably will be closed. So are you allowed to fax into Shabbos? Very, very fascinating question, because it's incredible. You're in Chol, for you it's Chol, and then you can send a fax or an email into Shabbos. You can be causing malacha work to be done on Shabbos. Very fascinating question. And as far as I know, most Rabbanim are lenient about this, Because they draw an analogy between this and the following question. The question, the famous Nimukei Yosef to Baba Kama Chaf Beis Min Aleph. Nimukei Yosef asks the question about something that all our moms, our wives, what they do, they light candles on Friday afternoon. How in the world could that be permitted to Ben Shabbos, licht on Shabbos afternoon? After all, that candle is going to be lit on Shabbos, and the halacha follows the opinion is going to burn on Shabbos, and the halacha follows the opinion of Eish Mishum Chetzio damage done by fire as if you did it directly. So burning fire is considered to be your action, as if you are doing the action. So that fire is burning on Shabbos. It should be considered as if you set that fire on Shabbos itself, even though you actually did it on Friday afternoon. You set it into motion. So explains in Mukhi Yosef that you are, as far as Shabbos is concerned, what we're concerned about is when you did your action. If you did your action on Friday, well, before Shabbos, we don't care that you are causing an action to happen on Shabbos itself, at least on a Torah level. Certain issues, there may be an exception, but regarding Shabbos candles, since you live before Shabbos, we don't view it as if you're doing the malacha, the forbidden activity of burning a candle on Shabbos itself. So l'chora would say the same thing about emailing and faxing into Shabbos, that you are, what concerns us is the action that, when you began the action, when you actually emailed or faxed into, when you sent the email, when you sent the fax, notwithstanding the fact that the malacha takes effect on Shabbos. So emailing or faxing into Shabbos would appear to be analogous to lighting a candle on Erev Shabbos. And just like lighting a candle on Erev Shabbos is certainly mutter, a mitzvah, certainly emailing and faxing to Shabbos would seem to be okay. That's an interesting question. What about a guy calling a coworker on New York Friday afternoon? Okay, right, that's right. Should you try to avoid it as a non-issue? Okay, well, certainly I want to clarify, you shouldn't call a Jew, because that's literally listening to Yerilos Tim. Actually, are you causing a Jew to violate a Torah, Torah prohibition or a rabbinic prohibition?
If you work for a stockbroker company, you're calling, I'm saying, when it's a big office, it may be Jewish, may not be Jewish, it should not be an issue. I don't know, we're just working, and you can't tell for that people, half the people who work office are Jewish and half aren't. And if you find out, you're speaking to Goldberg on the phone, do you do anything, or that's it, or you continue talking, with Shabbos in New York.
Right. Right, that's an important question, and it comes up a lot. It's a very hard question. L'chora, if it's a Jew, would be also to speak to them. That would seem to me offhand, unless some of the great Rabbanim have come up with a way to be lenient about that. But this is a big issue, very very relevant issue. It's interesting. Another big question that comes up now is a website on Shabbos. Does you not keep your website open on Shabbos? Maybe, maybe not. I'm told that B&H is a big store here in Manhattan that sells electronics, and they have a website, and I'm told they closed the website on Shabbos. Oh, that's an interesting question. I received an email from a Jew that was sent on Shabbos. Should you open it? Right, that's a very important question. Right, that's right. L'chora, I don't see right, Judah, should that be also to open that email on Shabbos? I don't think that because that would encourage him to send you emails on Shabbos. But if you deliberately choose not to open up the email, that will teach him in the future not to send emails on Shabbos. Maybe. You have to also be concerned about Chil Hashem. That's also a big issue. Which leads us into our next topic. And that is watching a Mets game on Motzei Shabbos. I'm sorry? My students occasionally send an email on Shabbos. Should be okay, like any malacha on Shabbos.
No. If another Jew does malacha, we only punish the Jew who did. Or I'm allowed to benefit from the malacha of a Jew after Shabbos.
Right, that's not right.
Even from a girl, I have to wait, on Kadesh Yasu. from a Jew, I don't have to wait anything. After Shabbos, it's mitzvah. There may be the policy issue, the chilul Hashem, but when my students do it to me, I'm always talking to them about this, we'll have a class. My students are thrown. They're studying. On more than one occasion, they send me emails on Shabbos. So usually, I'm in a very nice way, mention to them, you know, it's a non-denominational school. You can't push, you know, it's not so nice.
Right, I understand. I understand. Right, so, Shalom Bayis.
But it was written on Shabbos.
Sadly. Now here's another question that's actually related. I'm returning to the store I want to just talk about the website. If you hold it, you have to close, say a business has a website, if you have to close the website on Shabbos, because otherwise you're considered to be doing malacha. Give me just 1 second. Oh, okay. Just finish this thought about a website on Shabbos. The question is, okay, that's very nice. You have to close the website. If you hold it, you have to close the website on Shabbos. Well, who's Shabbos? Do you have to Shabbos everywhere? Or do you have to close the website only where Shabbos is for the owner? What if you have partners? What if one partner lives in Australia, one partner lives in New York? So does that mean the website has to be closed on where it's Shabbos in New York and where it's Shabbos in Australia? What if you have a lot of partners? So the website is going to be closed for a lot of Shabbos. Again, it just shows you the impact of time. Now here's a very interesting topic. Oh, Judah. Yeah, you wrote, right. He wrote Shabbat Tov in the email knowing that it would open on Shabbos. Right. Yeah, I hear. Yeah. It's sad. Yeah. Okay. Now let's talk about topic F3. Watching a Mets game on Motzei Shabbos. Now the reason why I mentioned Mets, not the Toronto Blue Jays or the Tigers, is because the New York Mets have an announcer, a broadcaster who is Jewish. I think his name is Gary Cohen. And the question that my students raise is that they turn on Motzei Shabbos, they turn on the television, and there they are watching a game from the West Coast, and there's a Jew broadcasting from the West Coast. The question is, are they allowed to sit and watch this game on Motzei Shabbos? So they're watching a Jew being Mechal Shabbos, and they're in almost real time, they're getting hana, they're getting benefit from halacha that Jew does on Shabbos. And we know the halacha forbids us from getting hana from getting hana from halacha from work that a Jew does on Shabbos. This is like watching Israeli news Motzei Shabbos. I would say it's more like watching Israeli news on Friday afternoon. Because his voice, Hana. Oh, very smart, Rabbi Kalman, as always. Right, that's right. That's the Gemara Pesachim. Call that a call for a voice is not, you're not considered to be Moel. Call and Mara and Reach, Ein Bo Mishum Me'ilah. Some of the Rabbanim want to say on that point. Yeah, okay, there's what to say. There's what to say about that. You're right. This is a big question, very very big question. I thought that personally, I felt that watching the Mets games on Motzei Shabbos, I thought it was a Chilul Hashem. VCTR for Shabbos afternoon. Oh, setting a VCR. That's what you want to know. The setting a right or VCR right for Shabbos afternoon. So that's the question about yeah. Rav Lichtenstein, I know, is very, or TiVo, right, that's, I've been asked that a lot. Talmidim, they asked me this. I know Rav Lichtenstein is Eish Lahava against it. He's incredibly against it. He's even upset to ask the question. What about
TiVo?
Well, what's TiVo? TiVo is another, there's a fancy VCR. Sort of. That's what my students explained to me. That's what TiVo is. Modern day VCR. There you go. Okay. Still in the Stone Age. Okay.
Not a bad place to be.
Not a bad place to be. But I thought that watching the Met games on Matzei Shabbos would be a Chil Hashem. I thought that for a Jew to be, from Jew to be sitting and enjoying a Met game and seeing right in front of them a Jew being Mechal Shabbos, I felt that a Jew should be pained by that. I thought it would be analogous to what Esther said in the Megillah. How in the world can I sit and watch and see my nation being destroyed? To see a Jew being Machal Shabbos and just sitting there in a right before I ask you publicly, and you're sitting there and you're sitting there and watching. I think that it was a problem. Right? What if a Jew was playing in the game? I learned to my big surprise. Right? What about turning off the sound? My great surprise. I was told that there are three Mets who are Jews. Which found that very shocking once when I discussed this with my students. And it's an interesting issue, but I think sometimes in regarding many of the modern issues, you have to look beyond the technicality. You have to look about the spirit of the halacha. And even if it technically will say that once Shabbos is done, the prohibition to have hana benefit from work that a Jew does on Shabbos, you know, that clearly would seem not to apply after Shabbos, technically speaking, just seems to be the wrong thing. Seems to be a bad idea. The close analogy would be to, as far as I know, is the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish was famous for saying that you shouldn't benefit from the work that's done by, you shouldn't use the Israeli electricity. The electricity generated by Israeli power plants. Right? And the reason why the Chazon Ish felt is that it was also, even if it didn't involve a technical prohibition of Masa Shabbos from benefiting from halacha that a Jew does on Shabbos, nevertheless, you are in violation. I'm sorry. Nevertheless, the Chazon Ish felt that it was a tremendous Chil Hashem to have religious Jews using the electricity generated by Isser on Shabbos. Okay. How in the world can you, the Chazon Ish felt, how can a religious Jew benefit from work that a non-religious Jew is doing, even technically it's not Matzah Shabbos, it's not technically prohibited, still we felt it was Bichil Hashem, it's a wrong thing, bad policy, and I think the same would apply to the Mets game. What's the Metzias of Mets game on Shabbos? Metzias is that, let's say Shabbos is finished 9 o'clock in New York, and the game is going on, the Mets are playing the Dodgers. The Dodgers are playing at 7 o'clock out in California where it's still Shabbos. And you have a Jewish announcer is talking away and doing all his, making all his announcements and play-by-play. And you're sitting there where it's after Shabbos, and sitting and watching a Jew being Mechal Shabbos. I think that's something. It's not something to watch. I mean, we don't believe in our community throwing stones at people who are Mechal Shabbos, but to just sit there and benefit from it, it's a problem. Oh, in the Israeli league, that's Shomer Shabbos. Ken Holtzman. Oh, Baruch Hashem. Good. Oh, I remember Ken Holtzman. He used to play. He was on the Oakland A's. He was a pitcher in the 1970s. Okay. Now let's go to our last issue, and we'll close up with this issue, and how technology has changed the way we look at place. Let's review what we've seen. We've seen technology has brought the obscure passages in the Gemara alive. It allows us to see things we haven't seen in the past. It bifurcated phenomena, fused phenomena. It's rendered the reasons for various halacha moot, and it has changed the way we look at time, and finally, technology has changed the way we look at place. And I'll give you three nice examples for this. One of the fascinating questions I saw raised by Rabbi Feitelevin of Australia is the question of, let's say someone is in a space station, and he has to make a sukkah. He wants to make a sukkah on the outside of the space station. So the question is, well, where on the space station does he put the sukkah? does he have to put the sukkah on the part of the space station that's facing the sun? Very, very interesting question. Just shows our whole concept of place is different. Even the question is, well, which is the roof of the sukkah? Where's the bottom? You know, which is the top? Which is the bottom of the sukkah? Tzeltem ruv mechamsa. Right. More shade than right than the sun. Right. unbelievable questions that come up. Okay. Now, then the question becomes, two other examples how travel has changed. Spirit of the law is important, so I let write questions previously about it. Right. Do I agree about VCR on Shabbos? I agree that there should be no, with my regular of local scene, there should not be VCR on Shabbos, even though I've heard, right, even though technically it's hard to say that it's usher, and right, I've heard that some rabbanim actually say it's permissible, but I know Rav Lichtenstein is against it. I was told the Rav also, Rav Soloveitchik, also objected to it, so I'll join the camp of those who say that RHS, what's RHS?
Rav Hirschel Schachter is also opposed.
Really?
Rav Schachter is also opposed.
Okay. Rav Schachter is opposed also. Okay. That's interesting.
Schachter.
Oh, Rav Hirschel Schachter. Oh, RHS. Oh, there you go. Okay, good.
My point is because spirit
right,
of law is important.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's very important not to lose sight of the spirit of the law. That's correct. Very, very good. It's a very important point. Now in terms of how we understand place, that is travel on Erev Shabbos. The Gemara says that we're not supposed to travel on Erev Shabbos or for a long distance because we're afraid the person is going to have to wind up traveling on Shabbos because they'll experience difficulties. As we all know, the stories that have heard about this. The Gemara puts a limit on how much we're allowed to travel on Shabbos, and that is 3 parsaot. That translates into 12 mil, which is about 8 miles. Now, it would seem that this distance would appear to be relevant in the modern age, because for us traveling 8 miles is not a big deal at all. That people travel eight miles all the time routinely, and a lot of us travel routinely a lot more than 8 miles. So it would seem that one would be allowed to travel a lot more than eight miles on Erev Shabbos. Maybe not by foot, but one certainly would be allowed to travel considerably more than that. But just bearing in mind, as Glenn pointed out, the spirit of the halacha, and that is that we should not be traveling for a great deal on Erev Shabbos, lest we come into Shabbos the last minute. And then finally, the last question I wanted to raise was that the distance required to recite Tfilas Haderach. And the Shulchan Aruch quotes from the Gemara, depending how you understand it, but the Shulchan Aruch rules that one is required to recite Tefillas HaDerech only if they've traveled a minimum of a parsel, which is 4 mil. Now, question becomes, what if one travels in a train, a plane, a car? Do we say that even when one has only traveled 4 mil, which is 3 miles, that's enough, that's a significant derech? It's significant on travel from our perspective to warrant reciting Tefillas HaDerech. So that the Mishnah Berurah says yes, that the rule of the 3 mil, that's, I'm sorry, the 4 mil, that's it. You say Tefillas HaDerech if you're traveling for more than 4 mil, that's it. But it's interesting that Mishnah Berurah writes that traveling the no more than 12 mil on Erev Shabbos, that one would be allowed to travel a lot more than that if one has a means in which one could travel faster. His example is if you had a horse and wagon, more than just traveling on foot. But when it comes to Tefillas HaDerech, that the Mishnah Berurah writes, that the halacha does not change despite technology. So it's interesting how in one area he says it doesn't change, and yet in another area he believes that it does change. That would be one would be allowed to travel thousands of miles on Erev Shabbos, provided that one leaves themselves plenty of extra time to get where they need to be on Erev Shabbos. And this is our practice. This is what people do. Very, very interesting. But not everybody agrees with Mishnah Berurah on this Tefillas HaDerech. And I would like to conclude this year with the following thoughts. We've seen how the technology has impacted on the halacha in 7 areas. I just wanted to make one observation, and this is my thought, and I'll throw it out for your evaluation. Just I began the shiur last week discussing how obscure passages of the Gemara have come alive and how possibly have found takdimim, precedents for every new issue that comes up within the Gemara, with Rishonim and Achronim. I find that remarkable. I find that God's hands in the composition of the Gemara. It would seem to me that God's hand in halakhic history plays a role here as well. So I find that it's fascinating that the era of the commentaries of the Shulchan Aruch ended basically right before the beginning of the technological era. So what I mean by this is follows. The era of the Rishonim ended around the time of the Spanish Inquisition. At that time, and around the beginning of the year 1500, the beginning of the 16th century, that's when the Shulchan Aruch was starting to take form, and then over the next couple of hundred years, the printing press is a huge change, right? No doubt about it. But after Shulchan Aruch was published, then you had for a couple of hundred years, you had major commentaries being written on the Shulchan Aruch, the Shach, the Taz, the Magen Avram, the Vilna Gaon, Rabbi Kiva Eger, Chassam Sofer. But when did this process end? So this process would seem ended with the Chassam Sofer, proceeding to be the last commentary on the Shulchan Aruch in the early 19th century. But then, at the heels of the end of the year, the major commentaries of the Shulchan Aruch, you had the Sifrei Hapsach, the Sfarim that offer Psak Halacha, a final ruling. And these came about in the early, middle, and late 19th century, right before the technological era dawned. To my mind, this is the Yad Hashem. This is my humble opinion. Why? Because we needed to have a Mishnah Brura, an Aruch HaShulchan, a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, a Chayi Adam, Sfaradim to have a Kaf HaChayim, even though that was completed a bit later. But all these great works that give us an authoritative ruling regarding all the various disputes that occurred in the writing of the Shulchan Aruch and all its commentaries, and finally have resolution. So once you have these great works in place, then we're ready for the onslaught of technology. So in my humble opinion, take it or leave what you think, I believe that Hashem arranged that the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, the Chayi Adam, the Mishnah Brura, the Aruch HaShulchan, to be published right before the dawn of the technological era, because then we have the halachic authorities and more of halachic clarity established by works such as the Mishnah Brura and the Chayi Adam, the Aruch HaShulchan, through which we have authoritative sources so that we can resolve the avalanche. There's no other way to describe it other than a very powerful avalanche of shilas that come up literally every day, new and more difficult shilas regarding technology's impact on halacha. And Kadosh Baruch Hu was also to continue the Purim theme, Makdim L'Refuah L'Maka. He brought for us before the problem, he presented the resolution, and he somehow arranged that the modern halakhic works would be finished before the 20th century began. Don't you think we need an update, like an updated Mishnah Brura? Great Igros Moshe is one. Well, see, but that's important. Well, let me talk about what the Igros Moshe does. Basically, the Igros Moshe, in almost all cases, what they're doing is he's applying the Mishnah Brura and the Aruch HaShulchan and the Chayi Adam. Now the rules have been set. Now we do, in my humble opinion, the 20th century, the modern technology has brought about a new era in halakhic literature. I think I'm the only one that refers to it this way, but I still think I'm right. I don't think we agree on one source. That's a good point. But I think that the new era is the era of the appliers, applying the body of halakha to the new issues that come up really practically every single day. We're too divided now. Right, but Judah, I would add just that it's an interesting, that, that we're the era of the misogyny. Okay, this is a similar idea. Right, we like in the Encyclopedia Talmudia, that's true too, because we're trying to put some order to all the information that we have. But we also were in the era of the appliers, not just the people that were putting things in order. But technology also makes it a lot easier to order all the material that we have. Certainly, a lot of parts of the original sources would be intact, and certainly ample for Pesach to be reached in any of the previous eras as well. That's true, but it allows for some clarity, and we needed more clarity to be established by Svarim such as the Mishnah Berurah and the Aruch HaShulchan immediately before the dawning of the new era. I would just add in one thing to the point that Judah said, was saying before, that that we're too divided now. I think there's a positive aspect of there not being one source, because there's only one accepted halachic code, let's say, amongst, say, Sephardim. Many, many Sephardim view Rav Avadia Yosef's Yalkut Yosef as a new code. Many Sephardim view that as the code for almost all of their halachic shaylas. And that incorporates many, many questions. That sefer incorporates a lot of questions for the modern era. The Taimanim, the Yemenite Jews, have a similar code that's been put out by some of their leading rabbanim. But we don't have a figure like Rav Avadia Yosef that would write such authoritative works. But I think there's a positive to not being buckled in or limited to having the authority of one particular sefer. And as much as people try to make one authoritative sefer, such as, let's say, the Mishnah Berurah, then you'll always have another sefer, the Aruch HaShulchan, to come out and disagree. The Rambam thought he would have one final authoritative sefer, and lo and behold, then came the Hasakos HaRavid and the Magid Mishnah, the other Sfarim that are written to comment and criticize the Rambam and disagree with the Rambam. And that ultimately enriches us, and therefore there's a positive in not having one particular work being the only authoritative work. Gives us a lot of room to be flexible. Today there's a tremendous pressure to follow Das Torah in the Ashkenazic world. Rabbi Kelman, one could say there's, whatever that means, one could say that, I would change that a bit, there's pressure, let's say, within the Haredi community to follow, some circles believe that you have to follow everything that Rabbi Yashiv says. But I don't see why everyone has to be boxed into specifically Rav Yashiv said. Rav Yashiv is an enormously important authority, but that does not mean that everyone has to accept him. Look, when Rabbi Slifkin put out a new sefer on evolution, the executive vice president of the OU wrote haskama to the sefer. So I don't think, at least in our community, we don't necessarily view Rav Yashiv as the only authority. Elu ve'elu is in short supply. Well, maybe in Toronto, but not in Teaneck, I guess. I would say that Elu ve'elu, okay, I understand that the Haredi community is trying to push away Elu ve'elu. But I certainly, one of the things that I do try to get across in my works, Gray Matter, right, the title tries to, in my articles in Kol Torah, is to try to strongly emphasize that there are more than one opinion. And there's, halacha is not a monolith, even today, there are plenty of opinions. And Baruch Hashem, we have plenty of opinions. We need that because there's certain situations where there's more need to be lenient and some flexibility, and that we can't just be boxed into one particular posek. Even if that posek is someone like Rav Lichtenstein, let's say he fits into your Ashkaf. Nevertheless, we need the flexibility. Okay, I think we'll end over here. And thank you for joining us. Next week we're going to close up this series, talking about a very, very important topic, a vitally important topic, and that is wills and estates. And I'm looking forward to seeing you next week. Have a really, really okay.
All right.
Thank you,
Ilana,
for joining us.
Next week, wills and estates. Okay.
Thank you, Judah.
Very good. Okay, Yeshikorach. And we'll see you next week, guys.
Thank you, Rabbi Kellen, for this great opportunity. Really, Yashkan.
Thank you. Okay.